And if we look at a woman's pregnancy, and we look, even if we just look at hormones, you receive a thousandfold dose of estrogen, a form of estrogen during a pregnancy, thousandfold more than you receive in the entire rest of your life combined.
Yeah.
And we know from the animal kingdom, sometimes women tell ourselves different stories, but estrogen is a cognitive enhancer. It makes your brain better, makes you smarter, it makes you quicker, it makes you far better at defending your young and navigating around to find food and forage. It protects you against the diseases of aging. If you're a female mammal who's not a human, who's read a book on what to expect when you're expecting and maybe reads Instagram and listens to women's weekly magazines and thinks that you're meant to become dumber and more docile and, you know, perhaps suffer from brain fog or baby brain.
This is episode 127 of the Neuro Experience podcast. I'm Louisa. I'm your host. If you're new to the show, welcome. It's my hope and dream for everybody to understand their brain better. This is a neuroscience podcast, and I urge you to go through the episodes one by one and learn. Every topic is brought to you by world-renowned leaders and educators, and I do my best to uphold the standards and practices of evidence-based medicine by interviewing real scientists and real physicians. Now that brings me to today's guest, Dr. Sarah Mackay, who is a neuroscientist from Australia. This episode is like none other, as I too share a lot of my own experiences when it comes to the female brain. For women, understanding how the brain works during the stages of life, including in utero, childhood, puberty, adolescence, pregnancy, motherhood, menopause, and old age, is essential to their health. Dr. Sarah Mackay is a neuroscientist who knows everything worth knowing about women's brains, and she shares it in this extremely fascinating episode. Understanding how the brain grows and changes through the stages of life is key to health and well-being. This is not an episode about the differences between male and female brains, nor an episode using neuroscience to explain gender-specific behaviors, the battle of the sexes, or Mars versus Venus stereotypes. This is an episode about what happens in the brains and bodies of women as they move through the phases of life and the unique and often misunderstood effects of female biology and hormones. Dr. Mackay gives insights into brain development during infancy, childhood, and the teenage years, and also takes a look at mental health as well as the aging brain. The episode weaves together findings from the research lab, case studies, and interviews with neuroscientists and other researchers working in the disciplines of neuroendocrinology, brain development, brain health, and aging. In this episode, you'll learn specifically about the brain during childhood, puberty, the menstrual cycle, the teenage brain, depression and anxiety, pregnancy and motherhood, menopause, and the aging brain. We also have a lot of fun and commentary and laughter where I share some personal stories about myself and what it means to be a woman who experiences a crazy surge of hormones once a month. Without further delay, let's get into the episode. Neuroscience, neurology, longevity, and beyond. Learn everything you need to know from the best physicians and experts in the world. The Neuro Experience podcast is a platform to help you understand what the brain is and how it shapes every part of our lives. Every episode comes to you from highly credible sources. I'm Louisa Nicola, medical neuroscientist from Australia living in New York City. Come and take a Neuro Experience with me.
Well, why don't you start by telling us how you actually got into the neuroscience of, I'm not even going to say the difference between male and female brains. I mean, because what, you know, after spending some time with you pre-podcast and on the phone, you've kind of alluded to me that this is about a story about your own brain.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny because I think perhaps the best way to put that question in context is to talk about how the book came about. Because I didn't have this sort of book about the female brain sitting inside me waiting to come out. I was called by a book publisher one day who said, hey, do you want to write a book about something neuroscience-y? And I was like, not really, because that sounds like lots of hard work. And I know the kind of person that I am. If I'm going to do something, I will you know, it will take over my entire life. And I knew that writing a book would be something that would be an enormous task. Plus, I didn't really have any sort of specific idea in mind for a book. But she was very charismatic, this lady, Jeanne Rickmans, who's now my book agent, and said, come and have a cup of coffee and we'll sit down and have a chat. So I thought, well, she sounds like fun. So we went and sat down and had a coffee and a chat. And I was saying to her, look, I don't have the idea for a book. She said, forget about that for now. Tell me what you have ever written for an audience that has really resonated with them. And that was easy because a few years earlier I'd been writing for the ABC here in Australia. I was writing a brain blog for them, and I'd written an article on menopause and brain fog, so that kind of fuzzy, foggy experience that lots of women have when they go through menopause, and that fear and that worry that, oh, this is the first sort of signs of forgetfulness and Alzheimer's and dementia, and it's all downhill from here. And really it was reassuring women, it's probably quite normal to feel this at this point in lifespan, and you're not about to, you know, get admitted to an Alzheimer's unit. Anyway, we had an enormous outpouring of, oh, thank you so much for reassuring me, responses to that post. So I was telling Jeanne about this over coffee, and she said, well, there's your book. Why don't you write about menopause? And I was like, because I'm 40? That's something mum did with her friends. That's not my life experience quite yet. And then she said, oh, well, what about baby brain when you're pregnant? Is that a thing? And I was kind of, you know, again, reflecting on my own personal experiences, thinking, well, no, that's not a thing. And I'm from New Zealand, a Kiwi woman. We don't do baby brain. We just get on with it. But then, you know, as we had that conversation in a quite a light-hearted way, I realized, you know, I've been working as a neuroscientist in some form or another, you know, for my entire career, and I've been owning and operating a female body and brain my entire life. And because neuroscience, and you'd know this, is so broad and so deep, there's so many paths to go down, I'd never really thought about, hey, what experiences of in my life as a girl and a woman have shaped and sculpted my brain, and indeed, you know, how's my brain influenced my life experiences? You know, these experiences that you have as a girl going through puberty, your menstrual cycle, pregnancy. At that point, I'd done all of those things. At that point, menopause wasn't anything I'd considered. I'm 45 now. Your biological clock does kind of tick on, let me tell you. Life goes very, very fast. So I thought, well, you know, we understand that girls and women are more likely to be diagnosed with anxiety and depression. Is that because of our female biology and brains, or is that something else to do with, you know, women go to the doctor and ask for help? I realized that there were just so many questions about female, you know, the female experience of life and health that I'd never thought about before through the lens of neurobiology. And I also realized, because of the work that I've done, I've always worked in brain development and that sort of, you know, plasticity, you know, experiences shape and sculpt your brain, that kind of realm of neuroscience. I know that you can't get to any point in your life without your life history and your experiences being kind of carried through with you and your synapses. So I thought, well, I need to take a look at the entire lifespan. So I thought, well, I'm going to write a book about the womb to tomb. It was a bit of a big undertaking.
Yeah, it must have been.
But what I did was I went home and I thought, right, I'll start in utero, you know, childhood experiences of puberty. I went, you know, teenage years, just went through the lifespan and just wrote down a really long list of questions about each of them from the perspective of neuroscience that I didn't know the answer to. I knew the answers to barely any of them. And I realised, well, there's a lot that we can work with and research here. And so I sort of set off on this year-long journey of exploration of the literature, of talking to scientists, of talking to women's health experts, reading, writing, and it was an utter joy doing that. Sort of piecing together this book, this story of the female brain from womb to tomb, as I said.
Oh my God, I love that, especially as a woman. And like you said, what was just so interesting, you said, I've been operating a female brain. I love that because I have too. So the way I would love to structure, you know, this podcast is I want the listeners to elicit a kind of understanding about, first and foremost, and if you can weigh in on this, the structural differences. I think there's some questions out there, a lot of controversial questions, between the male and female brain. Are they different? If so, how? And I then want to draw upon some of the findings that I have found, and something that's really caught my eye and attention. And you can weigh in on this, because I know your lab was that at Oxford?
Yes.
Yeah. So did you study, I mean, a lot of the findings, they say that a lot of the findings on the differences between male and female brains were done on male rats.
Yeah.
So
for sure.
Then how can you really get an understanding on the differences structurally of a male and female brain if most of the animals that were being dissected were male rats? And when I looked at the literature on this, they said it's because rats and mice too go through menstruation.
Yeah.
They didn't want it to toy with that, which then begs the question of how much do our hormones during different phases of our life, like menstruation, like pregnancy, menopause, how much does that actually change our brains? Why don't we start first with the differences structurally of male and female brains.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting question. And I have to admit, when I was writing the book, because I was so focused on puberty and periods and the pill, or pregnancy, they all start with P, I'm not sure why, premenstrual syndrome. And then I would say I'm writing a book about the female brain, and then people would almost automatically ask, oh, well, what is the difference between the male and the female brain? And I was kind of like, that's not what the book's about. I'm writing a book about periods and puberty. But anyway, I realized I needed to kind of address that difference. There was enough to deal with otherwise, but I thought, got to kind of go in and take a look at that. And I think it's really complicated. We simply cannot, you know, have a room full of, you know, women, a room full of men and women, say that's half and half, males and females. And when I use those terms, males and females, men and women, in this particular podcast and also in my book, I am broadly referring to people who are born as a male or a female and identify that and have grown up as that. There is very, very little research, and looking at transgender issues. So I sort of set that aside in the book, and I'll set that aside now just because it's complicated enough. But if we had a room of 100 people and they were half men, half women, and we were to kind of lift the lid on their skull and peer inside, we simply would not be able to divide the room up into men on one side and women on the other based on just the sort of the gross anatomy and basic structure of their brains. Or if we were to be less crude, perhaps, and pop them all in an MRI scanner, we're not going to be able to go, let human in the scanner, they're a male or they're a female based on what we see in the structure of their brain. Perhaps the one giveaway might be that on average men's brains might be slightly bigger than women's brains. And that's because on average men's bodies are slightly bigger than women's bodies. But of course, there's plenty of overlap. We only need to line a group of 50 men up and a group of 50 women and look to see that lots of the women are going to be taller than lots of the men. So that's a very recognisable sex difference between males and females, is height, is body size. But that doesn't mean that you don't get plenty of overlap. One of my siblings is 6 foot. Mm-hmm. One of my parents is 6'3" and one of my parents is 5'3". Mm-hmm. Dad's 6'3". My mum's 5'3", but I've got a very tall sister. She's taller than lots of blokes.
Yeah.
So again, whenever we start trying to make individual assumptions by simply looking at brains, it sort of starts to fall down, because there is so much variation in any population, including within any group of women, including within any group of men. So if we're just looking broadly at structure, occasionally we might see some structural differences, but they don't necessarily always then translate directly into behavioural differences or differences in cognition or differences in emotion, differences in kind of how we think and how we feel. If we do see any differences in there, often they are, we can't necessarily pick up on that by kind of looking at gross anatomy. We kind of need to start digging a little bit deeper and maybe looking down the microscope, or maybe doing some kind of analysis of how the circuits function. But by and large, My female visual cortex and my husband's male visual cortex function in pretty much the same way. Auditory cortex does. But what might be different is when you start digging down into parts of the brain, say, that might be involved with reproduction. And so women have circuitry in the brain that's involved with ovulation. Mm-hmm. Of course, men don't. Mm-hmm. But the differences that we start to see structurally are often reasonably hard to kind of find once we sort of start digging around. And because there is such variation within a group of women and within a group of men, there's often a massive amount of overlap. And that's, I suppose, what we need to recognise, and we need to ask the question in a much more sophisticated and nuanced way rather than saying, are they different? Go, well, what are the differences? If these differences exist, how different are those differences? Because often the differences are quite tiny, and we tend to focus on very, very, very tiny differences and ignore the massive similarities.
So then so basically you're not saying that structurally, like, the cortices are the same in thickness, in structure, but the things that are really involved, like when a woman is pregnant or when she is menstruating, there's certain areas of that brain that may be different. They may differ in size. Now, is that due to neuroplasticity? There's obviously a long thought belief amongst neuroscientists, neurons that wire together, fire together, neuroplasticity. Can it grow a certain area of the brain structurally? Like for me, in my early 30s as a 32-year-old woman, I've been menstruating for quite some time. More than half my life.
Yeah, I've got 30 years of experience of that too.
So does that mean because I have been doing that once a month, my brain is pretty attuned in terms of neuroplasticity? We know the highways. It knows what's going on for, you know, 2 or 3 days of that month. Mm. And it's like, okay, great. Mm. So therefore that area of the brain is, which I would love for you to touch on, which area of the brain that is, that area of the brain is, it may have been structured. It's now a bit developed more so than a male's area.
Well, I suppose it's, if we're to look at, say we're looking at the menstrual cycle and we're looking at the regions of the brain, including the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland and all of these kind of, we call them the hypo, HPO axis. I was going to say HPA. HPO stands for hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis. So that's an axis of the brain and the ovaries that are in constant communication with each other. Now, males don't have an HPO axis because they don't have any ovaries. So when we are talking about that axis, we're talking about the kind of the signaling pathways, the conversations which are going on and taking place. And yes, those conversations are continually feeding back from the ovaries to the hypothalamus, to the pituitary, and round and round and round it goes until perhaps you're pregnant, perhaps you take the pill, or perhaps you start going through menopause. When you go through menopause, the ovaries sort of start winding down, so the conversation becomes a lot more sort of, it starts to stutter and fits and starts, and then that brain area that controls the ovaries will sort of start changing slightly. Of course, men are never going to be seeing that. They're not receiving that same signalling back because they don't have ovaries. They're not signalling back in that same way. I think one really useful way to think about more broad-scale structural changes that are seen, and this is a reasonably recent study in terms of sort of the neuroscience literature that kind of came out sort of 2016, 2017, was taking a look at some of the structural changes that take place during a pregnancy.
Yeah.
And this is one of the more significant structural changes that we do see, in which we could go in and go, actually, that woman's had a baby, that woman probably hasn't had a baby. And so the study was done.
So your brain would look different to mine.
Slightly different, Well, my brain definitely would have looked different in the first year or so after my first baby was born. Okay. We haven't been following these groups of women long enough to know. Mm. But it was a really interesting and cleverly designed study that was published from the head author of the group is called Alseline Hoeksema, and I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, based in the Netherlands. And they got a large group of parents or prospective parents in who were trying to fall pregnant, and they scanned all of the women's brains before their first pregnancy and then after their first pregnancy. And there were also women who were trying to get pregnant who were included who hadn't yet had a baby. And it was fascinating. They did MRI studies on the structure of their brains, and in all of the women, within a month or so after that first pregnancy, after their baby was born, the same regions of the brain showed, and cortex showed structural change, and actually they got They got kind of slightly narrower or thinner. Don't like to use the word shrink, but they did slightly shrink. Now, people freak out and they think, well, parts of your brain shrink. That must be some sign.
I can hear every male out there going, yeah. I knew it!
Yeah, well, they think it's some sign of degeneration. Well, teenagers' cortex, as they go through their teenage years, their prefrontal cortex also shrinks as it refines its skills, as it gets better at what it's doing. And that's often about getting rid of the superfluous connections we don't need and focusing the action in on the ones that we do. So often what we see in the brain is as a skill develops, that part of the brain gets, we might can think about it, it's becoming more streamlined, okay, kind of leaner and meaner and better at its job. And in all these, every woman that went through a pregnancy, the same region of cortex got thinner, it got better at its job, it got leaner and more streamlined, and it was the parts of the brain involved with social cognition, with empathy. So if you think about that, the woman's going through pregnancy, their brains almost got better or got prepared for the act of motherhood, both perhaps being able to interpret their baby's thoughts and feelings and needs, and perhaps also to kind of pull in that so-called tribe of we need other people to kind of help us nurture and look after this baby. And the differences were so striking that they were able to pop it into some kind of artificial intelligence recognition program. I'm not probably using the right lingo there. And it could say, yeah, that woman's had a baby, that woman hasn't. And this is within the first sort of month after pregnancy. What was really interesting, as a kind of, you know, we like to have a lot of checks and balances and caveats and double, you know, check everything as what it is in science. They scanned the brains of the dads as well. And they were reasonably engaged fathers. They were part of the study. They were in the Netherlands, which is a part of the world where, you know, there's great gender equality and the men are very involved in their children's lives, and the changes were not seen in these men's brains. So we can make a reasonable assumption that it was probably the pregnancy itself that initiated these changes versus that first month of caring for the baby. That's typically what we think. And similar findings have been found in female mammals in the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
And they don't read books on what to expect when they're expecting. They just do. They behave in certain ways, what we would call these kind of maternal behaviours that we would see in the animal kingdom. And certainly those maternal behaviours we see reflected in changes in brain circuitry. Mm-hmm. And these changes are all guided by a lot of the hormones, that kind of biochemical cocktail of hormones that we experience during pregnancy. And if we look at a woman's pregnancy, and we look, even if we just look at hormones, you receive a thousandfold dose of estrogen, a form of estrogen during a pregnancy, thousandfold more than you receive in the entire rest of your life combined.
Yeah.
And we know from the animal kingdom, sometimes women tell ourselves different stories, but estrogen is a cognitive enhancer. It makes your brain better, makes you smarter, it makes you quicker, it makes you far better at defending your young and navigating around to find food and forage. It protects you against the diseases of aging. If you're a female mammal who's not a human, who's read a book on what to expect when you're expecting and maybe reads Instagram and listens to women's weekly magazines and thinks that you're meant to become dumber and more docile and, you know, perhaps suffer from brain fog or baby brain.
Yeah, so brain fog, you know, next time, like I'm Greek, I have a lot of cousins who use the excuse of baby brain whenever they're pregnant. I'm going to really reflect on this episode.
That has been really well studied, actually, by cognitive neuroscientists, because it's pretty easy to get a group of pregnant women in the lab and say, do you want to sit down, have a little
bit
quiet?
That must be a scary lab.
Put your feet up, have a nice bit of quiet time, and let's do some cognitive testing on you. And there's a lot of research done in this space looking at, you know, comparing a woman before, during and after her pregnancy, or comparing a group of pregnant women and a group of non-pregnant women. And the vast majority, not all, but the vast majority of studies don't find any clear cognitive differences. Mm. In the animal kingdom, we see cognitive enhancement. And the humans, us human women, we tend to not see any really clear cognitive changes, which is interesting because that is counter to what lots of women claim, which may, we think, if we do see this, the studies that do find these cognitive differences typically find it in the last stages of pregnancy, maybe even that last trimester. And if you've gone through a pregnancy yourself, it's really hard to sleep at the end of pregnancy. You're uncomfortable. You're kind of a bit hyper alert. It's really, really hard to get a good night's sleep. What happens when you don't sleep well? Cognition fails.
Everything
starts breaking down. And what happens when you have a baby? you know, those first few months, your sleep is massively disrupted. So probably you are forgetful, you know, not feeling the same degree of emotional regulation. Things probably are a bit fuzzy and foggy, but it's probably not a result of the pregnancy and the hormones per se. It is probably a result of the fact that you're not getting enough sleep and rest. Mm. And, you know, you could talk to dads. They probably suffer from baby brain. They haven't got the pregnancy hormones. They're suffering from lack of sleep and the huge life shift that happens in that space and time.
We've gone from, I want to focus on more so, because you talk a lot in your book about the phases, okay, the female brain during different phases of their life from, mm-hmm. you know, obviously childhood, adolescence, puberty. What happens during the brain of a woman who is menstruating? There are so many, we touched on it earlier in the episodes. Now, I will talk from my own experiences. Sometimes I feel like I can definitely be clinically diagnosed with some sort of disorder during the first, I would say, 5 days prior to menstruating, mm-hmm. which is probably the deepest about myself that I've gone on the podcast.
You're very brave.
I'm very brave, and I'm putting it out there because any type of advice would be warranted. However, I would love to know not just your own experience, but I would love to know from a neurobiological perspective what is happening in the brain of a woman during or even pre-menstruation.
Mm. Well, we do know, excuse me, that we know, again, quite a reasonable amount from the mammals of the animal kingdom. And I think they're useful in a way that to study, to kind of draw out what are some of the experiences that we've grown up with and the narratives that we've had and the stories we tell ourselves, and kind of tease them out from a lot of our biology. And if we look at the brains of mammals who are going through what we call an estrus cycle, we don't call it a menstrual cycle in animals, we call it an estrus cycle. So again, we've kind of got the rise and fall of various hormones. In particular, let's look at the hormone estrogen, which is produced by our ovaries, particularly around the time that we ovulate. If we look at, we zoom in with a microscope and take a look at the neurons of female mammals, we look and zoom in even closer into their dendrites, we see we have lots of little spines and projections which receive synaptic inputs from other neurons. And estrogen, as it kind of goes up and down, can influence the kind of growth and flourishing and, again, the retraction of these little spines on dendrites. So we have a reasonably clear kind of story there, and some beautiful diagrams that we could look up in. Probably any modern standard neuroscience textbook will have images of these little spines flourishing in response to estrogen. And so we assume that the same is happening in human female brains, but we don't always know, because most living female humans don't really like having little segments of their brain taken out to study under the microscope just to see what they're looking like while they're ovulating. But most likely that is the case. Now, whether that's happened globally throughout the brain in a human, we don't necessarily know, but definitely there is that influence there. We know throughout the brain of humans, based on what we know from animals, there are estrogen receptors, the intracellular receptors. So estrogen is able to make its way into the brain, diffuse through the membrane of a neuron, and interact with estrogen receptors within inside the cell. So we know that that happens. I suppose if we kind of zoom out and then go, right, well, we've kind of got a bit of an idea about how some of the circuitry changes. Can we then draw a nice neat line from changes in the brain through to predictable responses in thinking or feeling or cognition? And I was really interested in this, so I wrote an entire chapter about the menstrual cycle, because I thought, hey, we've all kind of got this monthly neuroscience experiment going on in our heads where we can take a look at what's going on.
Can you repeat that?
Like a monthly neuroscience experiment in our own head.
That is golden. I love that.
Well, that is if, you know, you are having your period still, like, you know, you've gone through puberty, you haven't gone through menopause, you're not pregnant, or you're not on the pill or some other contraceptive, which might mean you don't get your period. And there's lots of really good reasons for all of those, all of that happening. So I was like, wow, wouldn't it be interesting to know if the natural fluctuations of hormones you'd see in a healthy cycling woman change our cognition, our ability to think and make decisions and remember and plan. So I went in. There's not a ton of research on that, but all of the research that I did find, and there were a couple of meta-analyses that have been done pulling together all of the data, didn't really show any clear variation in cognition with women as we go through our monthly cycle, which as a Kiwi is quite affirming. That's why we've got a really good female prime minister, right? She can make decisions. She does quite well.
The way she handled COVID-19.
Yeah, and I'm not at all an expert on Jacinda Ardern's uterus or her brain or her pregnancies or anything like that. But based on my own experiences, I think I have managed my cognitive life reasonably well, despite the fact I've had a monthly period.
Mm.
Mind you, I've also spent many years on the pill. That's another story. So certainly the literature supports that having a period doesn't mean that you are more or less cognitively enhanced or, failing at any point in time. That is a little bit different from taking a look at emotional experiences. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, surely that's going to be pretty obvious, right? Because women, we're emotional creatures. We're all sort of on this hormonal roller coaster we can't get off.
Mm.
And it influences, that's why we are so hysterical. So I went in again, took a very careful look at the academic literature that's looked at very granular measures, very careful measures of emotion and emotional responses. And, scientists don't go in and go, well, was she happy or sad? We're like, let's look at a very specific measure of, an emotional measure we can do. And again, it was interesting because there appeared to be very little support for this idea that emotion is deeply influenced by the day of the month or your hormonal status. During times of, hormones kind of going shooting up or going down, perhaps as you're going through puberty or perhaps as you're withdrawing from the hormones of pregnancy, there was a bit more of an influence. But in a healthy cycling woman, there didn't appear to be a lot of support that there were deep correlations, strong correlations between hormones and emotions, which was a bit of a surprise to me because, of course, there's PMS, which you've talked about already. You feel really cranky and irritable and struggle a lot in those few days before your period. And I thought, well, that's interesting. How about I just take a look at PMS?
Yeah.
Because that's a thing, right? So I thought, well, how many women suffer from PMS? That's a really easy question to ask and answer. It was not an easy question to answer. I was floored by the data that I found. I came across a really interesting meta-analysis that was done looking at different reported rates of PMS around the world. And this study really surprised me because the rates varied somewhere between 5% and about 95%, but it depends on which country you live in, which I had no, as I say, neuroscience is a big subject, right? I had never gone down this kind of research path before, and I was really surprised. So if you were looking at French and Swiss women, you were getting kind of around 10 or 15% of them were putting their hands up and going, yep, I suffer from PMS. Jump over the border to Spain, it was more in around 30 to 40%. In Asia, it was around 50%. You'd go into some countries in the Middle East, it was around 80, 90, even 95%. So it's really interesting once you sort of started looking at the variation between countries and obviously reported rates. And I thought, well, if it's purely hormonal, why does it vary so much by country? There must be something else going on in that.
Yeah. Well, so much of what you've just said, and I want to know if I'm wrong in thinking this, is it based, a lot of the things that you're talking about, you're not actually talking about structural differences. You're actually talking about environment. Environment might shape our perception. Our perception may shape the hormones that fluctuate throughout our bodies and brains, which then in turn gives you this quote-unquote PMS feeling.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important because I went quite deep into this. There's a bit of a phrase that I learned from talking to a lot of psychologists and counsellors. It's about the meaning we make. The meaning we make of our life experiences, of the sensations in our body, of the context that we're in. So I was really, within this PMS space, I was really quite puzzled. So I started looking at, I looked at some of the data around how we would define PMS, and obviously there's hundreds of definitions and symptoms that women may experience. If we look at PMDD or premenstrual dysmorphic disorder, which is when women are definitely suffering really serious emotional and physical symptoms in that week before their periods, so much so that it disrupts their life, there would probably be about 5 to 10% of women on the planet where that's a very, very clear, obvious outcome. And I went and started looking at some work by another Kiwi, Sarah Romans, who's a women's health psychiatrist, who was aware of this literature. And obviously she gets women coming into her psychiatry practice, and she's seeing a subset of the population with very serious mental health issues. You don't just see a psychiatrist because you just need someone to chat to. But she said time and time again, women would come in and the primary root cause they believed of their various emotional issues or mood disorders, they always kept blaming hormones. She was like, why are we always defaulting to our reproductive capacity as the reasoning for this? She was aware of this regional or global variation in PMS reported. So she designed a study in which women were, there was a sort of a phone app that popped up on their phone, and hundreds of women were recruited in, and every day they were asked to record a number of different data points in there. So they were asked to record the day of their menstrual cycle, their emotional status, and they were given an emotional valence scale, which included positive emotions, neutral emotions, and negative emotions. And that's really important that there was an even distribution of that. It wasn't skewed to 8 negative emotions and 1 positive one. So the data wasn't skewed. So that was designed very carefully. Women were also asked about, what's your stress level today? How socially supported are you feeling? And how's your physical health today? What's really telling about the study is that women were not told it was a study about PMS. They were told it was about mood and daily life. We're just gathering a lot of data points from the study.
Minimising bias,
incredibly important, and especially the emotional valence scale.
Yeah.
Because a lot of studies have been done. It's like, how are you feeling today? Tired, sad, cranky, weepy, angry, irritated, happy.
Okay.
So we've only got 1 positive and 8 negatives to choose from. So that was carefully designed. And when they crunched the data, what the data showed was there were only a very small number of women, about 5 to 10% of women in the study, who showed a clear correlation between mood and day of the month.
Mm.
When the study was done and they were told we're doing a study on PMS, the data was actually quite different, which shows that there's a bit of a sort of a story in there, meaning we are making about the time of the month and the emotional experience we're having. Now, there was 5 to 10% of the women who did show a very clear mood variation, which is the same number as what we see in women who are diagnosed clinically with PMDD. Okay. But what about the women who did show mood variation? What was fascinating was there were very strong correlations between mood and physical health, how stressed women were feeling, what a surprise, and really interestingly, how socially supported they felt.
There you go.
So I was talking to Sarah Romans on the phone and I said, well, does this mean, are we denying women's lived experiences of PMS? She's going, no, it's not in their head. These are real symptoms. But often it is what we are choosing to attribute them to at different times of the month. Often, not always, but often based on some of the stories that we are brought up with by our mothers and sisters in the society we're in. And that's where we're seeing some of these differences. And what some of the differences that have been observed is in countries where there's less gender equality, there are often higher rates of reported PMS. And it's almost as if, and the feminist kind of narrative behind this, along with Sarah Roman's story, and I'm just reporting on this data, is that women, it's almost as if, well, there's kind of a few days in the month when you can kind of just like let it all hang out, and you're kind of entitled to actually be pissed off and irritated and angry instead of being a nice, good woman, which you are most of the month. There's a bit of a time in the month you can get away with it, which is really one really interesting way to think about it. And as she also said, it's really important to educate people on this because you can't always do much about your hormonal status.
Mm.
It's kind of just your biology. You can take care of yourself physically, but you can do an awful lot about how to manage stress, and you can do an awful lot about how socially supported you feel and how socially connected you are. So in a way, this kind of research doesn't dismiss women's experiences. It just gives them more meaning that they can make out of their experience and more agency over the choices they can make towards their emotional health and well-being. So we're not dismissing an experience. We're saying, hey, let's just take a look at what is the root cause of this. Maybe it's hormones, but maybe it's your husband just didn't put the bins out.
Yeah.
Maybe there's another cause which we can, also address.
Yeah.
So I think it's about that. And that's not to say, and I really hope that the message is that that's not to say there are some women whose hormonal status does absolutely impact mood, But for most women, it's often something else.
Mm.
So it's kind of almost wow. like I say, we're looking for I used to think about this with my kids all the time when they were little babies. It was like a baby would cry and they'd go, oh, they're teething. And I'd go, he doesn't have teeth. It's nothing to do with teeth. He's just cranky because he's tired. Or, you know, we become forgetful when we are in our 60s and so we decide that it is dementia. Well, my kids can't remember where their shoes, their lunchbox, their school bag, their music instruments are every day of the week, and they haven't got dementia. It's almost kind of what we might default to blaming and then seeking out. And that's what cognitive bias is, right? We're just sort of seeking out, you know, data points to prove what we think and feel and the meaning we've made versus maybe being a bit more scientific and looking for other answers.
What has striked me so far so much in this episode is you've actually... You've actually cleared up a lot of questions that I've had my entire life. And one of them is our brains are shaped by the environments that we live in, which actually is very indicative of your last comment when you said that PMS and the results from women are skewed to where you live. And that comes into cultural differences, that comes into everything. So what you're trying to, you know, what I've gained from this is you shape your brain via the experiences that you have. Your brain isn't structurally changing. It's not structurally different in size, in matter under, you know, normal circumstances, but the way you perceive threats or even this PMS thing or even stress, which I'd like to go into, is formed by the perception that you have. And that's how you, and so what are you trying to say then during a woman who may feel this surge of PMS, all these raging hormones, anger, they can really change it by changing their story?
They may be able to. I mean, not every woman. And as I said, there's a proportion of women, a subset of women in which they are far more vulnerable to fluctuations in hormones. And there's lots of biological reasons for that. So we're not dismissing that at all. Like some people are far more susceptible to some kinds of drugs, for example, than others, because all of our biology is different. But perhaps there may be some women listening to this who go, actually, maybe a lot of the stories that I've been telling myself, I need to start exploring different stories and I need to start being a bit more reflective about what are some of the other potential causes of how I feel and behave. Perhaps something that I can, you know, that these are things that I can do something about, changes I can make. And I would use the word agency in there, and that we have agency. We have the power and the ability to perhaps not just change how we think, but also change the context in which we're in. So that's always part of it. We, you know, these little human babies are born all over the planet in all of these different places. And we, you know, our brains are so plastic as humans and so adaptable and so shaped and conditioned by the environments in which we live. And even if we just start talking about male versus female brains, we're born into this incredibly gendered world, and little girls and little boys may be brought up. Some families, you know, they may have had some gender reveal party before they're born and, you know, set at the bush alight.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, those little children are expected to behave in a certain way based on their perceived gender. You know, how we are born, where we are born, and how our brains adapt and respond to the environment is just as important in shaping who we are as we get older than just only our hormones, just only our biology. They're always an interplay.
Now, is that the same for stress? I'd love to understand more about the stress hormones, cortisol, and how it, you know, can our brains change from stress under stressful conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, cortisol is a hormone that's released from the adrenal glands in the kidney. And typically, if we are faced with, and I don't like always using the word threat. I prefer to use the phrases threat, challenges, and opportunities, because our autonomic nervous system, that part of our nervous system which is responsible for sort of coordinating our body's response to the situations we're in, responds to not just scary things that are out there to kind of, you know, chase us down and hunt us and eat us or make us feel uncertain or scared, but also enable us to rise to a challenge or, you know, perhaps respond to a really exciting opportunity. So we have these different branches of our nervous system which do that. The sympathetic nervous system is that branch of the nervous system which kind of enables us to respond, you know, kind of turns everything on. So perhaps you are being chased down by a lion, or perhaps you are about to give a presentation on stage, or perhaps you're about to walk down the aisle and you're at a wedding, or perhaps, you know, you're waiting for, the announcement of a birth of a child in a family. You know, you've got a lot of ways in which, you know, your body is, you know, anticipating some thing that's about to happen, and your brain will be perceiving this threat, challenge, or opportunity. There'll be various circuits and networks involved which will kind of culminate in on the hypothalamus, and then eventually the hormonal signals which will be triggered and released that will go through your blood and turn on various hormonal systems. One of them is cortisol. Now, cortisol has a pretty bad reputation because we tend to always think about cortisol, stress, negativity, fear, spiraling down into anxiety. But we all need a little bit of cortisol in our day. It's a bit like a Goldilocks hormone, just to kind of keep everything ticking over. We don't really kind of want to be in this state of over dramatic excitation, but we also don't want to be in a state where we can't even get out of bed, where we're completely lacking any kind of drive. So our autonomic nervous system is in this kind of constant state of balance, kind of getting us into this sort of state in which we are able to respond appropriately depending on what's going on. So release of cortisol is important and is useful. So it's a Goldilocks hormone, too much or too little, and you start getting into trouble. Now, cortisol floods and goes all throughout our body along with a whole lot of other kinds of hormones and neurotransmitters which are part of any threat, challenge, or, you know, excitation response. Cortisol, if it's going on for far too long, you have far too much of it for too long, perhaps you're in some case of prolonged excitation, perhaps prolonged fear, prolonged uncertainty, even like kind of, you know, you're in a really sort of super exciting situation. I do a lot of public speaking, or I used to in 2019. Love it. Find it fun and energizing. But if I do far, far too much of it, I become exhausted because there is a lot of cortisol involved. It's not fear, it's just prolonged activation. I need to kind of find ways to wind down. Cortisol is easily able to enter our brain and can interact with a lot of regions in our brain. Now, I have heard some really kind of crazy neuroscience out there. You know, there's a lot of neurosplaining and pseudoscience out there, as you all know. There's a lot of people who talk about the brain and neuroscience who aren't even trained as neuroscientists. Drives me a little bit bonkers, who might say cortisol was released from the amygdala in response
or
to
the
fear.
Or the
pituitary, yeah. It's not. It's released from the adrenal glands and the kidneys. But it does enter the brain and it can interact with cortisol receptors or glucocorticoid receptors, as depends on which mammal you're looking at, what name you want to give them. We'll just call them cortisol receptors to be easy. And then they can trigger off various responses within the brain and nervous system and other cells. And some of these can be incredibly good. They promote health. Some of these can be incredibly damaging, especially if they're excessive over a long period of time.
Yeah.
So again, I think we need to kind of move away from thinking about cortisol as a switch that gets flicked on in response to fear and only has negative impacts on our body. Actually, it's about our body trying to maintain hemostasis or kind of balance. And, you know, we've got a lot of systems in play and a lot of feedback loops which enable that to happen. But any prolonged, excessive, incredibly stressful event, whether that be positive stress or negative stress, might in the long term have detrimental effects. And we do see, we can see that long term in the brains of people who have perhaps experienced a natural disaster or experienced excessive grief or experienced excessive trauma. We do see impacts in terms of brain function, and particularly once people are, you know, getting into old age and this happens, they can be far more vulnerable to the diseases of aging, or when perhaps they're going through particular transition points in time, perhaps little children when their brains are very, very plastic and their stress response systems are developing. When their stress response systems are plastic, they're continually activated, the brain and body goes, oh, well, I live in a pretty stressful world, and so I'm just going to adapt to live in a way in which I'm constantly kind of slightly alert.
Yeah.
You know, hyper alert, hyper vigilant. That's how we kind of see this. So we need to always take sort of a lifespan perspective on this.
Yeah.
When we're looking at this and not consider it as a switch that gets flipped on that necessarily has a negative outcome.
I often see that makes so much sense because I often see in my own father, he was born and raised in Cyprus and he came here with his 8 brothers and sisters and just his mum at the time they came here on a ship. It took them Wow. like 3 months and he had to, you know, he's a very smart man, but he wasn't able to finish school in this country. He came here and he had to literally, he was one of the eldest, so he had to go out and earn money to give. And I think about that, and he was 16, 17 at the time and didn't get, you know, what we all have now. And he worked incredibly hard, and it makes me think about why he's always in that fight or flight, you know.
Yeah.
He sees everything as, you know, because his whole family had to be split up. They left the eldest sister in Cyprus, so she got, you know, because of the war, he saw a war, he saw his house get torn down. So,
yeah.
And it does, you know, now it makes sense when sometimes you live in that. But my question.
Yeah, people are particularly vulnerable to that. There's a quote in the book from a researcher in the space who says we've underestimated the importance of childhood because it used to be a few years ago that was kind of dismissed. Childhood trauma, you'll get over it, you'll be fine, some people are okay. And some people are, but lots of people aren't. And it's because your brain is developing up until your mid-20s. Your stress response system
is
developing.
Is that for both men and women?
For men and women, yeah, boys and girls. Yep. Girls' brains tend to kind of start going through that phase from childhood to adulthood development slightly earlier than boys, but that's because on average girls enter puberty slightly before boys, but some boys go into puberty quite early and so their brains therefore do too. So puberty triggers that sort of transition, but girls might go earlier, but the boys eventually catch up just as their bodies do, their brains do as well. But because they are going through these really And the teenage years are an incredibly important time for brain development. We talk a lot about early childhood and brain plasticity and critical periods, perhaps for the development of language skills. And the brain is, you know, going through a plastic phase. It's, you know, primed to learn language at certain points in time. Teenage brains aren't kind of offline. They're actually really, really, really online, and they're going through their own critical phase of development, particularly a lot of those higher order cognitive functions, especially social cognition, the ability to think and feel and interact with other people. That's why it's so important for teenagers to belong and be part of a tribe, and they're very self-conscious and, you know, family matters more than parents and everything's all very socially complex because their social brain is developing and those social interactions and engagements matter. And they're interacting with other humans of the same age and brain stage where everything's kind of, you know, changing so rapidly. Okay, so they kind of need to go through that shift. And also those parts of the brain are involved in emotional regulation. So, you know, how am I going to assess this situation? What's my emotional response going to be? Yeah. Can I step back, be more thoughtful about it? Metacognition, being able to sort of think about your decision-making process, whether you're making the right, you know, is this thought accurate based on the evidence? Mm-hmm. A lot of these higher order functions are going through this critical period of development in teenagers. And so your dad, his world shifted, and what an incredibly stressful phase of life to experience when your brain is going through that critical period of development.
Yeah.
So we need a lot of compassion for people who have experienced that. I think, you know, it doesn't mean that you're doomed to always, you know, not grow up or to always sort of struggle emotionally. And, you know, there's a world of counsellors and therapists and psychologists out there who work in this space who, you know, kind of help people learn those skills later in life to cope. But,
Does the brain know the difference between a perceived threat and an actual threat, or does the brain recognise differences in trauma? So, for example, I understand if you go through one breakup in your life or a divorce, it can have a very detrimental effect on the brain. But does the brain know that this was an emotional trauma, or for someone who has been hit by a car, concussed, and that's the brain experiences trauma from that? Does it know the difference between the two?
Yeah, well, I think there's a big difference between physical trauma to your body where, you know, you're bleeding out or you've got a, you know, pain, you've got broken bones, you know, you've got all of the body signals feeding back up into the brain saying, you know, I need to increase my blood pressure and heart rate because or else, you know, because I'm running out of blood. That type of physical trauma is going to be different than perhaps the difference between, seeing a snake slither across your path, which you see here in Australia all the time, or across by your front door, as I sometimes see where I live. But we are very, very, very good at imagining dreadful situations, and we can make ourselves sick. We can keep ourselves awake at night. We can make ourselves physically ill. We can spiral down into very, very deep depression, and we can trigger off anxiety responses purely by the only thoughts in our head. And we only really have to take a look at how 2020 has impacted so many people that there's no, you know, the virus is invisible. There's no clear and present danger. It's not knocking at our door, with a gun in its hand. But the messages that we are reading and then the thoughts that we are having about this threat, and it's a real threat, you know, we're all trying to do our best, but a lot of the stress responses that we are experiencing, a lot of the anxiety and the fear is because of the thoughts in our own head. They're not made up and fake thoughts, but they are still thoughts in our head that we are imagining. And it's interesting. I was sitting around with some of the women in my mother's group. So I've got boys who are 10 and 12, and I quite often get together with the mums who I've known since our babies were born 12 years ago. And we were all saying how we've never worried so much about our children as we have this year in their entire lives. And we don't know whether it's because they've all started high school or whether it's a year of worry. It's a year of uncertainty and a year of anxiety, and everyone's slightly more on edge and slightly more hypervigilant. And again, there's a lot of meaning that we need to make out of these emotions and experiences we're having. And maybe we don't really need to be worrying more about our kids, but we were saying it's almost as if they started high school and then we could relax, but we're still sort of grasping around for something to latch on to worry about, to almost justify the anxious feelings that we are having.
Which is all uncertainty.
Which is, look, I don't even know what's going to be happening next week. I don't know when I'm going to see my mum in New Zealand again. My husband doesn't know whether he's ever going to get back to Ireland to see his parents in the next few years. Are the kids going to be at school or not? One of my kids has got a broken leg. How's he going to cope?
Yeah.
You know, there's just so many things that we don't know, and when we're in that state of uncertainty, well, our brains don't really function very well because they're essentially prediction machines, which are always, you know, making decisions about how we think, feel, and act and behave, you know, based on a best guess. And that leaves us in a real state of anxiety.
Yeah, that's, you know, the whole time that I've been listening to this podcast and talking to you, I just think that this is the reason why the Neuro Experience exists is because I'm turning it into a library to understand the brain better from professionals like yourself who have been in the field for, you know, 20 plus years, and you've done your time, and you're absolutely magnificent. The book that you've created is phenomenal. And I love that you haven't gone down the traditional pathway. You've gone down this pathway of, I'm going to create a course that teaches people. It's basically neuroscience 101, isn't it? Because I looked at it, like, what is a neuron?
Yeah.
You know, what is a brain cell? And yeah. I love that. What even provoked you to do that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I worked in academic research for quite a while, and felt the further along I got in my postdoc career, by virtue of the fact I was an academic scientist, I had to narrow my focus down and become an expert on a particular field. And I got FOMO, and I missed out on all of the other really interesting things there were to learn about the brain, apart from, you know, this one particular synapse and this one nucleus that I was looking at using electrophysiological techniques. And so I got kind of a bit frustrated. But I still loved neuroscience in general. And since it's been about 10 or 12 years since I had my kids, really, that I left the research lab and moved more into communications, I've seen this growing interest, growing interest and thirst for people to understand the neurobiology of human behaviour. Why do I think and feel and behave the way I do? Now, one massive problem I've always had with this, and as I said before, there are a lot of people talking about the brain who aren't neuroscientists, and it frustrated me no end in that. It's like, surely if you want to know about neuroscience, you talk to a neuroscientist, and there wasn't a lot of opportunity out there for people to do that unless they toddled off to university or managed to, you know, sort of scrape their way through an academic textbook or download some open access paper online, which they may not be able to understand. There's a lot of people out there focused in on educating kids, which is absolutely great. But I saw so many people doing such good work, especially in that helping people space, who, you know, maybe they were in their 50s or 60s and neuroscience wasn't even a discipline back then. They have this absolute desire to help people that they're working with, and they understand that a little bit of neuroscience embedded into the work they do that's accurate, is evidence-based, is simple and clear, and will enhance the work they do, will give people another tool. And I just saw that there was this huge, huge kind of gap in how those amazing people could access that information without having to head off to university. Mm. And I thought, well, I have, you know, education has given me every opportunity in my life. So I said, I grew up in New Zealand. I had the most loving, wonderful mum and dad. But they both left school when they were 15.
Yeah.
They were really hard workers, and I had learned such great work ethic from them. But they had no concept of university or intellectual life. Or I'd never met anyone who went to university until I went to university, except my GP. And education gave me everything. It changed my world. And just because you aren't 18 doesn't mean that you shouldn't have those same opportunities to have education transform the work that you do. And because so many people want to know about neuroscience, I was like, I just want to be the neuroscientist that teaches them. This is a neuron. This is a synapse. This is a neurotransmitter. This is how neuromodulators influence emotions and motivation. This is what we know about healthy brain aging, because there are a lot of people out there talking about that without teaching anyone a lot of the basics and giving them the strong foundation on which to then build their skills and knowledge, teach them critical thinking skills, and enable them to perhaps, you know, go a little bit further down the path of their particular discipline. So it was really important to me to make that education opportunity accessible to you, even if you were, you know, a 55-year-old female psychologist living in Ballarat in Victoria. Mm. Those opportunities should be there for everyone.
Oh, look, I absolutely applaud you on that. I agree with you. I've even for myself, I'm seeing a lot of, I would say, pseudoscience. There is a lot of people talking about, for example, we've spoken about nootropics, and but then nobody really understands this thing called the blood-brain barrier and what actually enters, you know, and it's interesting. And I see there's so much science, and you'll agree with me when I say so much, you need to know so much science, so much about the brain just to be able to teach it so simply, just to even be able to say what a neuron is, even an astrocyte, a glial cell, all the different types of brain cells that do exist, because if you don't know this much, you can't teach it well. Actually, I think Einstein say that he said something like, you have to be able to teach something well, you need to be absolutely brilliant in it. So,
Another really useful way to understand something well is to figure out how to teach it too.
Yes.
And I think what I've also tried to do is to try and teach people the neuroscience that's incredibly relevant to the work they do, because not everyone needs to understand resting membrane potentials, and we don't really get into that because really there's not that many people out there that are really interested in the resting membrane potential.
Or
rods and cones. It's all very important to neuroscientists. But as I say, you know, if my market is, you know, this wonderful woman in Ballarat who's been working as a clinical psychologist for 30 years, for example, and I get people from all around the world who come from all different disciplines, you know, they really want to understand how is an emotion created, how much stress is too much stress, why does childhood trauma impact, you know, later life experiences, how do we make decisions, why can't we multitask, or can we? And a lot of people, you know, they may be, I'm really interested in mental rehearsal and visualization. I've seen athletes do that, musicians do that. How does that actually work on a neural level, and what can we take from the neurobiology and apply in a really practical way? So it's almost also for me has been about curating the important information, what they need and what they want, and giving them a skill set as much as anything, not just giving them information, but giving them an education that provides them a skill set as well, so they can use this neuroscience, which is so cool and exciting, without overwhelming them.
I think that is absolutely amazing. And I'm very honored that you came on the Neuro Experience podcast. I'm going to link absolutely everything that we've spoken about to your book, to your website, to your course. We're going to link it all in the show notes. But do you have social media? You do.
I do.
Instagram?
Yes, I'm on Instagram, Dr. Sarah Mackay on Instagram. And
I'm going to find you. And
I don't do like live Instagram video stories.
We might have to do that in a part two episode.
Like, anyway, maybe we'll do that. I'm still trying to work up the courage. Maybe in my fifth decade of life, I should get on with that kind of carry on. But no, I'm on Instagram and Facebook and, have a weekly neuroscience newsletter, teach. I'm very findable. Just put in Dr. Sarah Mackay and you'll find me. Okay. If you're in America and you don't know how to spell it.
And we're going to put it all in the show notes. So Dr. Sarah, thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast.
Well, thank you. It was a delight to get out of the house and cross the Sydney Harbour Bridge and, meet face to face. So thank you.